This suit that I'm going to talk about was originally scheduled for tonight, but I think it fits better in the sequence to talk about it now. And then tonight I'll give the talk on the four Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta. And then tomorrow the two talks will be on the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta and then the Fire Discourse, and we'll be up in the main hall, kind of like last year. It was inspiring. And so then those three talks will be given in the order that the Buddha gave them, his first three talks. And when it seems to really start coalescing during the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. You really see how these things fit together and the not-self characteristic. This talk speaks of the five clinging aggregates in relation to dependent origination. And again, just for this talk, it's best to remember dependent origination simply states from ignorance, suffering arises. Don't get too caught up in the process. And the last thing I'll say about that is, and it's kind of the underlying theme of our retreat and all the retreats that I give and what we do at the center, is a very specific type of emptiness. If the problem is ignorance, then the solution is to be empty of that ignorance, isn't it? And that's the way the Buddha used the word emptiness, or the idea, more as that verb rather than a noun, meaning a destination to, we should develop an awareness of the all-pervasive emptiness of all things. Well, that's not really it. It sounds good, but that's not what the Buddha... That's not useful in the Dhamma. So another way of looking at being empty of ignorance is to empty ourselves of clinging, because that is what follows from ignorance, isn't it? So empty ourselves of clinging to ignorant views. And then this describes that. So the Fena Sutta is another sutta on emptiness, as the Buddha uses this term. In this sutta, he teaches the emptiness of the five clinging aggregates and the emptiness of creating self-identities by clinging to fleeting objects, events, views, and ideas. The Buddha teaches the emptiness of perceptions rooted in ignorance. He uses the words like foam on the river or a drop of water, the emptiness of magical teachings, and the ignorance necessary to follow mirages, the futility of following dharmas lacking the true heartwood of his Dhamma. And I'm not using the word dharma now to refer to Mahayana teachings. Any teaching is considered a dharma in that way. That's how the Buddha often referred to other teachings himself. The sutta follows from what the Buddha awakened to. The Buddha awakened to dependent origination, which shows that from ignorance of Four Noble Truths through 12 observable causative links, all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing disappointing and unsatisfactory experiences follow. So I'm not asking now, do you understand in a very detailed, intimate way every link in the chain of dependencies of dependent origination, but you all understand that it is from ignorance that suffering arises? Okay, so you all understand dependent origination. The five clinging aggregates are form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and resulting thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. These five clinging aggregates provide the appearance, the mirage, of the establishment of a substantial and permanent self to a mind that is ignorant of these truths. Is that clear? So the five clinging aggregates are simply defining the personal experience of suffering. These five clinging aggregates are empty of wisdom and empty of understanding. And the more that we continue to cling these aggregates together to define a self, the longer we'll be empty of understanding, empty of wisdom. The Buddha's entire teaching is always in the context of Four Noble Truths, to empty oneself of this initial ignorance and to recognize and abandon all self-referential views arising from that initial ignorance. The reference in this sutta to appropriately or clearly examining or clearly seeing impermanent phenomena arising and passing away means observing life unfolding from the refined mindfulness of the framework and guidance of the Eightfold Path, supported by the concentration developed through shamatha, vipassana meditation. In other words, the Eightfold Path is designed, put in place for us to develop so that we can see things clearly, develop right view. The Fena Sutta. The Buddha was staying with the Avijans on the banks of the Ganges River. He addressed those assembled. Friends, suppose that a large glob of foam were floating down the river and a person with good eyesight, not me, saw it and clearly examined it. To them it would appear empty, void, without any substance. For what substance could there be in a glob of foam? Now, the important line there is that they had good eyesight. They had developed the right view. They understood how to see things clearly. In the same way, any practitioner well-versed in the Dhamma observes and appropriately examines any form that is past, future, or present, any form that is internal or external, obvious or subtle, common or extraordinary, near or far. To those well-versed in the Dhamma, it would appear empty, void, without any substance. For what substance could there be in a form? Especially a form that is constantly changing. So that's in reference to the form aggregate. Constantly changing is a reference to the three marks of existence, right? Anicca, anatta, dukkha. Everything is impermanent, including these things that we think is a permanent form that houses this permanent self. Like a glob, like foam on the water. There's nothing there, nothing of substance. The Buddha continues. Now suppose that in the rainy season it is raining fat, heavy drops, and a water bubble appears and disappears on the water. A person with good eyesight sees this and clearly examines it. The water bubble would appear empty, void, and without substance. For what substance could there be in a water bubble? In the same way, any practitioner well-versed in the Dhamma observes and appropriately examines any feeling that is past, future, or present, any feeling that is internal or external, obvious or subtle, common or extraordinary, near or far. To those well-versed in the Dhamma, it would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance could there be in feelings that are constantly changing, like a drop in the water? Yet, don't we mostly define our lives by how we feel? Day to day and ongoing. I'm having a really bad day. I'm having a really bad week. I don't like the way you talk to me. It's defining our existence by how we feel. And every one of those feelings is like that drop on the water. Now, suppose during the hot season, a mirage was shimmering. A person with good eyesight sees it and clearly examines it. The mirage would appear empty, void, and without substance. For what substance could there be in a mirage that is constantly changing? In the same way, any practitioner well-versed in the Dhamma observes and appropriately examines any perception. I missed a section here. I'm sorry about that. In the same way, any practitioner, well-versed in the Dhamma, observes and appropriately examines any perception that is past, future, or present, any perception that is internal or external, obvious or subtle, common or extraordinary, near or far. To those well-versed in the Dhamma, it would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance could there be in perceptions that are constantly changing? And that's in reference to the perception aggregate. Now suppose that a person with good eyesight is seeing heartwood, In seeking heartwood, they went to a forest with a sharp axe. There they found a large banana tree. Heartwood is the part of a tree that's useful for making something out of, usually the internal part of a tree. They find a large banana tree. They cut it at the root and remove the top. They peel away the outer skin and fail to find even sapwood. Banana trees are not good to build anything with, except to pick bananas off it. To say nothing of finding heartwood. Having good eyesight, they clearly examine the banana tree, and the tree would appear empty, void, without substance, in regard to heartwood. For what substance could there be in a banana tree? So that's a useful metaphor there, because in seeking heartwood, the banana tree is empty of anything that's useful, isn't it? But yet, there's something that's useful to a banana tree. In the same way, we place specialness on things that have no substance, they have no heartwood, even though they might produce a fruit of some kind. Am I using that? Am I making that clear? Mm-hmm. So what are you seeking? If you're seeking to constantly reaffirm ignorant views, the world is a perfect place for doing that. It's full of banana trees. But if you're seeking the heartwood of the Dhamma, where do you look? You have to look in the Dhamma for that. As the Buddha would say, in the same way. In the same way, any practitioner well-versed in the Dhamma observes and appropriately examines any fabrications that are past, future, or present, any feeling that is internal or external, obvious or subtle, common or extraordinary, near or far. To those well-versed in the Dhamma, fabrications would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance could there be in fabrications that are constantly changing? And that's in reference to the fabrication aggregate. Now, suppose a magician were to display a magic trick, and a person with good eyesight clearly sees the trick. The trick would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance could there be in a magic trick? In the same way, any practitioner well-versed in the Dhamma observes and appropriately examines any consciousness that is past, future, or present, any consciousness that is internal or external, obvious or subtle, common or extraordinary, near or far. To those well-versed in the Dhamma, any consciousness, ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance, would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance could there be in consciousness that is impermanent and rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths? So that reference to the magician is also a reference to that feedback loop that we catch ourselves in. And we are now the magician, except we don't realize the trick we're playing on ourselves. Ongoing ignorance. So that last is in reference to the consciousness aggregate. The Buddha continues, seeing these five aggregates clearly, the well-instructed follower of the Dhamma grows disenchanted with form. They go disenchanted with feelings, disenchanted with perception, disenchanted with fabrication, and disenchanted with thinking rooted in ignorance. They grow disenchanted with the five clinging aggregates. It's a nice way of putting it, isn't it? How we develop an understanding of the uselessness of these things, that were these aggregates that we're using to describe ourselves. The completely impermanent nature, like foam on the ocean. And so why wouldn't we grow disenchanted? Through that understanding, we grow disenchanted with this thing that we were also enchanted with maybe just a moment ago. This form, this thing that we call me, I, ongoing I-making. We realize the futility of it, so we stop doing it. Like Lao Tzu said, once you recognize the impermanence of all things, you'll let go of everything. Why? Once you really understand it, like the Buddha described it in the Gara Sutta, there's no effort, there's no analysis, you simply abandon it. And if you're not abandoning it, even though you've recognized it, it simply means you're still clinging to it. And that's not a bad thing, and it's not a good thing. It's just something to be recognized. I'm still clinging to form. What's the next step? Meditate and deepen your understanding of the Eightfold Path. Let me continue. They grow disenchanted with the five clinging aggregates. Disenchanted, they grow dispassionate. Through dispassion, they are released. With release, there is the knowledge that they are released. You understand the process. They are released from clinging to ignorant views. They know that birth is ended, the fully integrated life has been lived, and that's where most translations would say the holy life has been lived. The fully integrated life has been lived, and the path complete. They know that there will be no more moments rooted in ignorance. We no longer give birth to moments rooted in ignorance.
So, John, just a question, because is that your paraphrasing there, that they know there will be no more moments rooted in ignorance? Or is that
yes.
Correct?
Yes.
And the same thing?
There will be no more birth, right. Is the way it's written.
Because in the same thing, disenchanted with thinking rooted in ignorance.
There it's it says disenchanted with consciousness. That's it?
That was my question there.
Good, thank you.
Have a question later.
I'm sure you will. They know there will be no more moments rooted in ignorance. The Buddha continues, form is like a glob of foam, feeling a bubble, perception a mirage, fabrications a banana tree. Why would you want to hang on to a banana tree? Fabrications of banana tree, consciousness, pardon me?
If you like bananas.
Unless you really, really like bananas. Consciousness, a magician's trick. When you observe them and appropriately examine them, it is clear they are empty, void, and without substance. To anyone who sees them clearly, they are empty of ignorance. Beginning with the body, when seen with profound discernment, as taught by the Buddha, form is rejected, cast aside. When bereft of wrong views, the emptiness of form is seen clearly like a magic trick, and idiots babbling. No substance is found here. A well-informed Dhamma practitioner, their persistence aroused, should continually view the aggregates and be aggregates to be mindful and alert. They should discard greed, aversion, and deluded thinking, and make themselves their own refuge, to take to the Dhamma as if their head was on fire in hopes of gaining Nibbana. The end of the sutta. It's a good one, isn't it?
In hopes of gaining what?
Gaining Nibbana. Nibbana literally is translated to that you have extinguished the fires, meaning extinguished the fires of passion. It's often portrayed as Buddhist heaven, but it's the culmination of the goal. We've reached Nibbana. And that'll be even more significant when Saturday night when we do the fire discourse. That's directly related to that.
So. Can we all get a little turban and set them on fire?
That's a good idea.
Burning Man.
Yeah.
We saw a fire pit.
Yeah.
There's an interesting number of metaphors that relate directly to that, aren't there? Ending the whole wandering in samsara, wandering around in ignorance. And again, the Buddha's teaching points directly to that. It all goes right back to the beginning of dependent origination. The problem is ignorance. What's the solution? Be empty of ignorance. How do we do it? An eightfold path. How do we engage in the path? It's very clear. You learn to develop a meditation practice that does one thing, deepens concentration so that one thing can do one other thing, support the refined mindfulness of holding in the entire Eightfold Path, so that Eightfold Path becomes the way that we see the world and the way that we experience the world. Just like we've discussed before. And that, again, to emphasize the purpose of the retreat, to give ourselves the opportunity to experience what it's like to live within the framework of the Eightfold Path for a period of time. So. Maury, you had a question?
I'm kind of loath to ask it because no matter. Well, I feel like when I say something, the way that I heard it and remember this discussion will not be the way that you heard it and remember the discussion. So I remember sitting talking with you. You were talking about the writing on emptiness. This is fairly recently.
Mm-hmm. One of that three discourses on emptiness?
We were out somewhere, and you asked me, well, I said, I think I kind of understand emptiness, and what I said is that things are empty of inherent substance. And it says that over and over in here. And clearly they are empty, void, and without substance.
I remember that talk.
Wait, can I finish?
Oh, sure.
So you had said that's not what emptiness is. And I know you've talked before about emptiness, empty of clinging and all, but here, like, the first sentence of this is, in the sutta he teaches the emptiness of the five clinging aggregates. And in my mind, that's the way I always saw it, that they're just these things that come into being. They're just through contact, they're maintained through clinging and craving and da-da-da-da. They're empty, they're impermanent, they arise, they cease, da-da-da. And they create a lot of problems if we don't see them clearly.
Yes.
So, and you were like, no, that's not emptiness. And then I was like, well, where did I get all that? Because...
Did I really?
No, you didn't say that. But that's, I've heard these terms so many times. And when I said that, it was incorrect, I feel like. So, and here it must have repeated it 19 times.
I remember that conversation a little bit differently. So, in the context that I remember the conversation, that phrase, and maybe I misunderstood the way you were using the phrase, the phrase that everything is empty of an inherent substance or an inherent nature does apply to the five clinging aggregates. And that's the only way that the Buddha was using it. In other words, this is the context. The way that's used, the way that is used in a more common way, in the more modern application, is just that, that everything is empty of an inherent permanent nature, which is true, but it doesn't relate specifically to the Five Noble Truths. And then we get caught up in almost making an excuse that there's then nothing to do. And that's exactly what, we talked a little bit about this the other night, it's exactly how the Heart Sutra and the Lotus Sutra portray the five clinging aggregates in a very dismissive way, saying the five clinging aggregates are empty, meaning you don't need to even consider it, when what you need to consider is the emptiness of each aggregate, and that's what's important, to develop an understanding. And I know you don't do it. This is my answer to your question. I'm not saying this is how you see it. Rather than just missing this as empty phenomena, which is what that thought usually directs us to recognize in a very specific and discrete way each factor of the five aggregates as empty, and that's how the Buddha describes it. And he wouldn't go through the form and description of form as being empty, like a foam on the ocean. Mm-hmm.
You've lost me. I don't know if you've lost everybody else, but you've lost me.
Let me say it in a simpler way. It has to be taken in context.
But that's part. I am now. I'm just going to drop it now. So talk about conditioned thinking. Sometimes we're assuming what somebody's saying, and we're bringing in a whole bunch of stuff to a simple question, because you're so immersed in distinguishing between what Mahayana and Vajrayana and all that says, and the only place I've ever heard this term is in this sutta, in your class and teaching, and this particular discussion through retreats.
You've never heard the Heart Sutra?
I've heard the Heart Sutra.
It sounds like we're arguing now. Yeah. But you just said the only place you ever heard it is here. But of course, it's not.
I mean, but the discussions I've had are here.
Good.
What is the term that you're referring to again?
Emptiness.
The term emptiness?
Yeah. So empty, that things are, is that the five clinging.
How do you understand the emptiness?
That the five clinging aggregates are empty of any inherent substance. They're void. If you look at them clearly in relationship to ignorance and dependent origination, you can see them for what they are and be at peace.
You got it. Good for you.
Thank you.
That's exactly how the Buddha meant the term and how it should be applied too. And to see that, so we see the importance of the teaching then is to see this, the personal experience of suffering described as five clinging aggregates, as the experience itself is empty of any substance, no matter how intense the feeling might be. And again, bring this into an immediate feeling, take it out of the conceptual aspect of five clinging aggregates. Any disturbance in your mind that is rooted in ignorance is empty of any reality, any substance. There's nothing there. There's no reason to further react to it. Another way that I say it is to be at peace with a less than peaceful mind state. Because when you're not, you're giving substance to something that is like foam on the water, like a drop on the water. You know, it's a magician's trick that we're playing on ourselves to react to temporary phenomena. And again, just to try to take it out of the conceptual place somewhat, the five clinging aggregates are simply the vehicle that we use to experience suffering, experience ignorance. And so when you look at them clearly, especially in relation to the Buddha's teaching, especially in relation to quantum mechanics, there's no substance to form. It's just a coalescing of thought, isn't it? And if that thought is rooted in ignorance, the only experience that thought could produce is something. We've now used kalapas. We've used the underlying energy of the entire universe to create an experience that is informed by our thinking. And so if our thinking is rooted in ignorance, we're creating an ignorant form that we're identifying as ourselves. Did I get off the rails again with that one?
It's the same thing that you've been saying for class after class after class after retreat after retreat. It's the same thing. That's what the Buddha taught. It's very clear. All this stuff just comes in contact, clean, craving maintains it. It has no inherent substance. We give it because we're confused. We give it a lot of, and we need to stop doing that and see it clearly as it is.
It
just comes and goes, big deal. Let it come, let it go.
Yeah. Seems pretty easy, isn't it? why can't we all do that? Just let it go.
That's the question. No, but it's difficult.
Well, that might be the reason why the Buddha taught for 45 years and didn't just stop with the first sutta. Because it's a little bit more difficult than just stopping. We need to develop the context of how to see these things. Pardon me?
More difficult than just reading it one time.
Yeah.
Actually, you have to put in effort and you really have to...
That's the part you missed.
What was that?
I said John gave the answer to that right before you got here. That's what you missed.
But it requires, all this stuff where he said and that sutta, you become dispassionate with it, you disenchanted, that has to be that refined mindfulness that you have to keep going when one feels that hook of papancha or the paticca-sama pada pada pada. But that's when we feel ourselves rolling into story, it's like Kevin was saying over here again, it's that if this is not me, this is not mine, this is not I, it's just not. Don't tell a story anymore about it.
Yeah.
And we need the stick.
And you're right, it is the process of it.
It's habit, it's just a habit.
Yeah.
The process of extracting ourselves, of emptying ourselves, is very repetitive because there's not a lot to this, is there? Except we got to keep bringing it up. We have to keep reinforcing the Eightfold Path continually,
lifetime of building it up. Like I think five-thingy aggregates, on some level, you allow it to become like your compass, the thing that protects you from things, that gives you urgency to work on something, or not saying that it's healthy, but you rely on it for so long, you've given it a role in your life, and then. Often with children, a doctor will say, well, it took her 7 years to develop this habit. It's going to take her 7 years to undo this habit.
Yeah.
I may not be alive, it's just that hard is what I don't feel like it's impossible. And I feel like I understand it.
Yep.
And I feel like it's a key to unravel and loosen everything. But as hard as I work every day to develop it and to make it clinging and rot and tick and all that, it's going to take a lot of work to undo it. Plus, I think we assign so much value to our feelings, right? You hurt my feelings, you're not listening to me.
And everybody around you does, too.
Right, exactly.
Constant input from the world.
Right.
Don't say that to Dad. He will get upset.
Yeah.
And most of what
will be happy if we do this, right?
Most of what we do in life is a conditioned action, moving ourselves towards something that will make me feel good in this moment. That's what I want to do. And so what you're describing, that vested interest, is conditioned thinking.
Right.
Which is another accurate description. You could use the term anatta, conditioned thinking, confirmation bias, five clinging aggregates, all mean exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
And they're actually all intertwined. So what's the answer? Is to end the process of ignorance that sets all of that in motion, that sets that conditioned thinking.
Well, and when I think about that, I look forward to that, right? I think with right effort and some discipline and being able to hear it through my words or feel it in my gut, which is something I experienced last year when I was here, and different ways you can start to recognize it. I don't feel a fear of letting it all go. I have enough faith that whatever I'm using it for, not that something better is on the other side, but that I just think everything will be okay. But it's that letting go thing. And like even the other night, Frank said something. You were reading the sutta with the sickle.
Yep.
All right, and how that was so helpful to him in letting go, and I thought the way he described that was really helpful.
Yeah.
A very simple, the way Frank speaks. And so I really thought about that the following week, but that's still really hard for me. Like I can imagine that, I can use that, but that letting go is just really hard.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And in the end, it's like foam on the ocean. But what I'm saying is that right now, your perception. Well, but again, that's one of the reasons why I say continually, we got to be gentle with ourselves, because it's just when you come up against these views that seem intransigent, at that moment they are, and it can be bewildering and frustrating. I know what I need to do, but I can't do it. It's like you can't take one step forward, even though you know you got to go that way. What do? Engage in right effort and right view and take, and this is where the Ratana Sutta, where refuge comes in. Mm-hmm. You take real refuge. Refuge is a place of comfort and safety. You take comfort and safety and understanding first that another human being actually did this. And he's no different. The Buddha he always placed himself in the category of humanity. No different. If he can do it, I can do it. You understand that he gave his teachings, the Dhamma, even though they're repetitive at times. So I can follow that Dhamma, and we take true refuge. I mean, this is an experience of that third refuge, of a Sangha, a well-focused Sangha. We don't have to do it alone. And all of that is necessary. Why? Because it is so difficult. It's not something we can just hear once, or just like Kandana, and just, well, that sounds good, I'm just going to do it. Why? Because of conditioned thinking. All of that is, and just to kind of lead into tonight's talk, and all of that we discussed is part of dukkha. While we're in it, we're experiencing dukkha. So when the Buddha described profound right view, awakened right view, he said first is right view completely understands dukkha in all of its manifestations, meaning even when you're stuck in this place where you know I need to go there, but I can't go there yet, that's dukkha. More.
And the sutra that we read last night, the Buddha talked about, like, to the very end, he still had delusional, ignorant views. To the very end, he's going back on the moment of his awakening. Like, you could almost picture that kaleidoscope of there's ill will and clinging, and I see it for what it is. It's the foam. And then I go and I abandon it, and I do this, and I see that's arising. They can't exist together. And then, so like it just, that also gives me like a lot of confidence that he still had those views. They were still present in his mind until that laser-sharp penetration of concentration was able to stay with that fear and trembling.
Yeah. So thank you. Thank you so much for saying that. There's dukkha until there isn't.
Yeah.
And you're right. The Buddha described that beautifully in the Nagara Sutta. He's describing the troubled nature of his mind until it wasn't anymore.
And there's always a moment to let go of tension.
Well, and talk about bringing this down to the human level. The Buddha's describing the common human problem of dealing with dukkha and extracting ourselves, emptying ourselves of all of the manifestations. But even that statement, all of the manifestations, come down to one single thing.
Can I?
Emptying ourselves of ignorance.
I'll really work hard on not saying anything else.
Why?
For the next 5 minutes.
Okay.
But
we'll see about
that. Matt kept using the phrase today in the practice of, you know, soft belly, soft abdomen, you hear that so many times, but that continual letting go, because I'd be embarrassed. Well, okay, so yes, during the day, I'm letting go of clinging views of self. During the day, there is a lot of tightness in this abdomen. You know, when I check there, I'm like, holy crap, it's like a rock. And it's all what, Mary, that's what you're saying, like fear, whatever it is that we develop these protective mechanisms, I feel like that's going to be one thing, like, just to keep repeating soft belly, because you can't hold on to self with a soft belly or views or
right, yeah.
So tension, and that is all just an arising of some conditioned habit that there's something I need to get or push away right now.
Right, some feeling that has no, that is empty of any real substance.
And any time,
and yet it's manifested as tightness.
Right.
You can let it go. It's not mine. You look at it. This is not mine.
I'm at work and it's so busy, and I think I'm not going to get it done, and I can't stop and listen to you. That's where it comes.
I like what you said this morning, Laura, during our meditation, when. Particularly, and I'm sure everybody hears something different than means something, but when you said to let go in the throat and to loosening the tongue, letting the tongue relax, and then how all of that physicality does open the heart area. And even with the, the tightening of the abdomen and the response to the vagal nerve and the adrenals, that fight and flight, you're in a constant state of that, saber-toothed tiger, I've got to protect myself from that which is around the corner or right behind you.
All right. Eat that strawberry, soften the belly and eat the strawberry. Anyway.
Jen.
This might be a little bit off topic, but I struggled with the difference between five clinging aggregates and dependent origination. In my mind up until today, they've always been, it's like five clinging aggregates is like the cliff notes of dependent origination.
You could look at it that way.
But now what I'm hearing is that it's the aggregates are like the vehicle.
Yeah, actually, yeah.
The 12 causative links are like the process.
Yes, the dependent origination describes the process of suffering arises. The five clinging aggregates is the personal experience of that suffering.
I feel like you've said that to me a million times, but now I get it.
So isn't it good that I repeat things?
Absolutely. Am I signing something here?
John is repeating it.
Yeah, that's even an interesting. I don't mean to portray the Buddha as the great psychologist of all time, but he's often portrayed that way. But I think that's why he taught that way. He understood. He wasn't teaching psychology or even psychological theory, but he understood how to get to people's conditioned thinking. And how do you do it? It's a full frontal, persistent, but gentle approach. Keep looking. Look at this. Look at this. Look at this. Look at things in relation to the Eightfold Path. Eightfold Path. Eightfold Path. Blah, blah, blah. Because
well,
he knows.
He understood human behavior.
Pardon me?
Clearly he understood.
Oh, yeah. That's what I mean.
Because he finally understood his own meaning.
Because he understood his own thinking process. I know I say it often, but when I read his development and how he taught, he simply was the most brilliant thinking man that ever lived. But it's not like that elevated him above everybody else. What it comes down to is he knew how to describe suffering in a way that makes it understandable and the path is useful for human beings. Again, there's nothing difficult about it, except we have such a... I was talking to Kevin earlier. I've probably said this to other people. To me, when I look at dependent origination now, it's like this is the most obvious, simple teaching in the world. How can anybody not see it? Except it, I probably had to go through it 100 or 200 times before it even started to make sense. Mm-hmm. And why? Because I, as I was struggling with reading it a million times or 100 times, whatever it was, I still had not developed the right context to see it, to know how it applies. Mm-hmm. So if the only thing you ever read in your life is dependent origination, you're not going to do much with that piece of paper except blow your nose with it. It doesn't. It's completely useless, isn't it? But in the right context, and when you understand the context, then it makes sense. And the only reason I'm saying that is it does a simple and direct teaching can be very, very difficult at first. It can be very daunting. But it's only because we don't have the context to see it.
Yeah, and it also upsets a lot of the ideas that we have. Yeah. That we have.
It gets directly, even though we don't understand it, I think we understand the implications of it.
Right.
There's a lot of resistance to that.
What we know, but we know what we know isn't necessarily working or isn't healthy, or, you know, there's an insight there that you have in order to hear that. And, you know, like for me, you know, when we first started talking about mental fabrications, you know, that went off in my head right away and made sense to me.
Yeah.
So you have a knowing that some of this isn't right or isn't working or isn't the only way to go about approaching a situation. You have sense about that.
And a mind that is insisting on remaining ignorant has to ignore that. Mm-hmm. You know, even though you're feeling it and there's a part of you that knows it, that self-referential ego self says, we're not looking at this.
But there are things in your life that will challenge them for each of us. You know, for me, having children challenged 1,000 things like mental fabrications and other things that I held on to as truths.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And, you know, until you have, you know, a child standing in front of you, you go, nah, I don't think so.
Well, and
I mean, I said so, therefore it is.
And in that way, the recognition that you are suffering,
right,
with the right mindset can lead you. I mean, it's kind of, I guess it's what led me to look for some answers. It's what led the Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, think about his life. He could have just stayed in the palace and had everything he ever wanted. But he even saw that. He defines that as a confining space.
Right.
He was suffering within everything anybody could want. And that's what motivated him to start looking, learning. Oh, I would say so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because each
we
were all children at one time, and each child conforms to that family.
Yep.
Whatever the beliefs of that family is, the child is molded. And it's really the child's willingness to conform, to make life easier, you know, to conform. That's
life.
Rooted.
Yeah.
That roots us all in the difficulty of breaking out of that thinking.
That's exactly it. That's the initiating process for every one of us of becoming conditioned or
it's
conforming.
Well, the child in the family, but it's also the child in life.
Yeah.
Someone growing up in the '70s had a lot to do with me.
Me too.
And I know for my children, I'm not taking responsibility for everything they got going on. Not that they have a lot, but there's a lot about them that did not come from my household because they live in a world. So it's kind of those two things come together to form them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's not just family. It's not just, it's all of this. And so what is the, whether you're a parent, I was going to say, if you're as a parent, the most important thing you can do is to develop the Dhamma so you can show your children the right way. But as a person, as a citizen of the world, same thing.
Right.
There's such a huge, strong evolutionary bias, because if we didn't do all this, we wouldn't be here, and the whole, you know, biologically, genes are to be reproduced. So when you're cut off from a herd, or you're an outlier, you are not going to reproduce your genes. So everything in our biology mm-hmm. is geared towards not being on the outside, not right. being an individual, because you die that way, and then what mm-hmm. you know, you're not going to reproduce.
So. Yeah, and the more, like, to Lorna's point, and the more you conform, the more you're accepted as part of the tribe, the more likelihood you are to survive.
And
including the more likelihood your views will survive, the more you conform. And that's exactly what has developed, and it's exactly the reason why the Four Noble Truths continue to be noble truths, meaning useful. Because the same process has been ongoing throughout humanity.
No, but we spoke about the children in the household, the baby in the household conforming to the household situation, then going to school, conforming to school. We're really all the same. We're just like 40 or 50 or 60 years on from that stage, but we're all still doing it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We're just all babies grown up.
So right? how do we
the Dharma.
Stop conforming. That's the problem.
Two things. How do I describe awakening?
Fully mature.
The biggest radical of all time, the biggest nonconformist of all time in relation to his environment was the Buddha.
Well, then we become, the whole point of the path is becoming a true individual, to be truly, I shouldn't say point of path, because that'll come back to bite me in my butt, but it is the result, is to be able to be a true, responding appropriately to each situation with wisdom, not based on conditioning and, survival mechanisms and all this.
Why was the non-conformist stuff?
I'm sorry.
Oh, he went against everything that was... Every conventional teaching, every conventional spiritual teaching, every conventional societal teaching, the caste system, etc. He left his family. Well, that was a common thing that men did at the time. But everything he did was contrary to the way everybody else was living. All the systems that were in place.
Before he awakened.
Well, there was an element of it that got him motivated in the first place. But once he awakened, what he taught was contradicting everything that was out there.
I know, but sure, once you're awakened, you've got it. It's easy.
Oh yeah, and I should also say he wasn't contrary because he wanted to establish himself as contrary. That was the least important thing to him. He was contrary because it was effective, and it was effective because it went against all common beliefs, all conditioned thinking at the time.
I think you have to learn. You have to keep the practice going, and each individually, you're going to come to our understandings. Because we all have different circumstances in our lives and different people in our lives that come in and out, and different jobs and different work that we do. So we have our own process of understanding how the Eightfold Path will integrate, till hopefully we all awaken really soon.
I think by midnight tonight.
You learn to not react in the conditioned ways, and you learn to not just conform because you're already developed the mindfulness and awareness where there's some space created, there's some softening, there's some space created where your reaction is completely imbued with the Eightfold Path, so you are in right view and in right effort, and you're so in that it becomes whatever it is, you're walking the full path completely, which seems a far way off for me.
Well, Lori, but you are describing it exactly, so it can't be that far off.
It's so easy to slip back. I mean, I have so many things that I'm really, even though they're not horrible attachments, I'm not ready to get rid of certain comforts, and I will, elbow my way to make them happen, or I'm not ready to be patient enough when really the time is calling for patience. So I can see that it's just a lot of work. I might have days that go by where it feels like, I can be in it, I can be really patient, but then, I don't, yeah, it's just
feels like there's a lot of resources and reserves that need to be figured out through being in good practice.
So I'm going to ask Jen and Liz to comment on that, because you were both talking about that, the individuality of the application of the Eightfold Path.
I just was kind of thinking about how, well, I was thinking more about conformity, because what you were saying sort of making me think about conformity and how much of my agitations now recently has been the coming up against the opportunity to conform to something that I know is not the right thing, but that is the comfortable thing. And that, just that being in that space of knowing, you know, for just as a silly example, like at work, kind of recognizing that there's something somebody wants me to do, knowing that that's what they want me to do, knowing that as a people pleaser, I would prefer to just do it, but also knowing it's not right for me to do it, and kind of like struggling with that, or, you know, going to a family event and everybody wanting me to eat things that I don't want to eat,
or drink,
and not. Kind of not doing this, being in that space and not doing that, and that kind of relates to what last night's talk of sort of, and what Maura just said, which is where you're kind of like still of these two kind of conflicting.
Yeah, minds. Just like the Buddha described.
I know. I see. It's like I see that I can't conform anymore. Like I'm not able to conform anymore. And, mm-hmm. feel okay, but I also, you know, don't want to not conform still.
Yeah.
Still haven't given up that.
So you haven't given up yourself, and then all of the people in your circle have this reaction as the self that you're trying to let go of, and they're reminding you every time you see that. And then if you're not really in your practice, if you're headed. But from my experience is that I just get kind of thrown off my rocker and have to, like, you know, flail around in the water for a minute before I can center myself again, knowing that I'm not this old self, you know. That's impermanent. This is impermanent.
Yeah,
let's
right.
keep it going.
But I think that the positive in it is that ultimately, when I don't conform, I realize nobody really cares. Mm. Nobody really cares.
Yeah.
That's just the story I'm telling myself.
But we think they do. Yeah.
I can conform. Yeah.
When we're not conforming, we think that we're sticking out like a sore thumb,
right.
Which you think that a self-referential ego self would really want, but in that case you don't. There's that feedback loop again, isn't it?
Yeah.
That the thing that Lorna's talking about, that need to conform, is part of the conditioned thinking that we get caught up in. And so it's another good application, another good way of looking at the Ratana Sutta, taking refuge. I'm threatened now because I don't feel like I can conform to this. How can I not? I can take refuge in understanding that what I'm doing is something that, for one thing, is harmless to everyone, including myself, and it's something that I can actually do. I understand it. And that's where right effort comes into it. Reminds us, wait a minute. It's okay to not conform in this situation, to not have a whole chocolate cake, to practice these things, to not lie or engage in gossip. Even though that's a real good example, I think, of the need to conform when you're in a place where people are gossiping and you realize you don't want to, but it's so hard because everybody else is. But you remember, you take refuge, you can just keep your mouth shut. And that's enough. That's okay. You know? And in that instant, even though it's minor, really,
right.
You're deeply engaged in the Dhamma. And I guess maybe that's what I mean when I say it. It is simple. But it's hard to get to that point at first, isn't it? Mary was talking about that, the difficulties. And Lorna, too. I mean, in all kinds of different ways, we're all saying the same thing, and that's remarkable. We're seeing the Dhamma from our own perspective, from the way that we're walking the path, and we're all walking the same path. That's how the Buddha described this. That's the brilliance of it. It's applicable to every human being in every situation, despite their particular conditioning. It works.
You know? You asked me and Liz, and I feel like I spoke around the giggles.
Well, that's okay. That's so funny that you, what you just said, because I've been thinking about if this is such a fundamentally simple concept, why is it that you sound like you are completely insane when you talk to other people about it that don't have any basis in the Dhamma at all? I caught myself 3 times specifically that I can remember where it's kind of like throwing out the fishing line and the line's halfway out and you want to get it back because you start talking about it and people start asking you questions and you're like, oh, you know, you just want to put the brakes on and stop talking about it because people are like, what?
Yeah.
You know, so I don't talk about it.
Because you're trying to explain to people that have no context. It's like
try to
tell somebody. Well, what I know is that ignorance causes fabrications and fabricate.
Well, I was telling you, I started to talk to, because I told my mother, you know, and by the way, my mother said she was going to start to talk to me. Who schedules a meditation retreat? Mother's Day.
did you tell her someone who's not well concentrated?
Said,
or just someone that can't read a calendar?
John has apologized for doing
that. And we're stopping by our mother's house on the way home.
My thinking was, what's a better gift for a mother than to be able to come on the retreat?
Well, it's all okay. So I said, she said,
you bought that?
Well, she knows what it is, of course.
Yeah, well, she just knows. She wanted to know it from my perspective.
Yeah.
And I think I eventually mumbled something about being a fully mature human being, and she understood that.
Wow.
Right.
I'm going to say, well, that's going to challenge.
I got out of that one alive.
Well, and she's been on in her own faith, so, you know,
yeah,
many retreats and meditation.
I think that's a completely different.
It is completely different.
My mother doesn't understand why you would do it more than once a week. Why haven't you done that once this month? You know, why would you do it, you know, meditate again? And she rolls her eyes a lot. And why in the world would you pay? And you live in a retreat community. Why are you paying? And why are you driving 4 hours? And why are you going to New York? I'm like, don't worry about it.
Want to come along?
And then, Lauren, one thing about is the whole thing about, because I am, yeah, I have a habit energy of, you know, wanting to make my mom or John not, you know, think I'm a jerk.
You
and
do?
I do. And you know, whenever I just, like, even like this conversation with my mom, I'm like, you know, it's all right, you don't understand it, and you disagree, and it's both in a second, right? But I will fight really hard to try to convince her about why I'm going, and I know it sounds stupid, and you think it's dumb, and I'm like, just stop, Mara. Yeah, you don't understand it, that's okay. And she still loves me exactly the same. Whoever said that, like, they don't even care, they really don't care. It's just their conditioning that's going to argue with it. Or want you to do extra work. I've been like lately telling, like, just not doing what my boss completely is unreasonable that asked me. And like, she doesn't come back and say, like, why didn't you do that? You're fired. She's like, okay, you know, we'll figure out another way. I'm like, boy, you know that. Like, why didn't I start doing this a long time ago?
Just practice your strength. Don't try and...
I don't know about other people, Maura, but you've convinced your mother and myself that you're not a jerk.
But sometimes restraint can be the most
powerful.
The strongest thing you can do.
It is.
The restraint of responding, the restraint of taking the bait.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When someone tries to bait you,
Well, right away.
It's an aspect of right speech to avoid unnecessary speech that is likely to fall on deaf ears,
yep.
including explaining yourself to someone that you know is not going to understand.
Right.
It's okay
right.
to, Bingo. In fact, it is right, it's wrong speech to try and convince someone that what you're doing is good for you when they're
yeah.
not going to buy it.
Yeah.
Keep your mouth shut, you know? Yeah. Or, I mean, I was talking to Kevin earlier. When people ask me what I do, if it's not in the right context, I very, very rarely get into dependent origination in the 5 minutes.
Yeah, that's a good
I say I'm a writer and a meditation and mindfulness teacher. And most people don't want to go past that anyway. I mean, most people, I could stop at writer because, you know, that's about the lowest form of employment you can have anyway. So they'll stop there. You don't have to get into it, Kevin. I know you got. What do you say when people ask you what are you doing on retreat? Why are you going on retreat?
Well, I was telling you today.
That's why I asked.
People I worked with, I just said I'm going to relax this week.
Yeah. And they didn't pry you for any more, did they?
Right. It's okay. Yeah. You know, you're just gonna like a staycation.
Yeah.
Going on a bender.
Yeah, and because I don't really want to get into the big explanation of it.
Yeah, and you don't have to. Yeah. When it's useful, then we talk about it. Right. You know?
Or if someone asks you about it, that's another thing.
Yes.
You know, like, hey, what is that thing you're doing? You know,
if you think
like,
they're sincere, you can explain
right.
to them. You know,
you can gauge it by if they ask another question after you say something.
I noticed when I respond to someone where are you going? And I say, oh, I'm going on retreat. Oh, what's that? Or, you know, da da da. But I notice that I start to carefully explain that it's a meditation retreat, and then I'm like, all of a sudden, there's all this like eye making that kind of starts to want to form out of it. But like, and just because it's like all these different perceptions on what retreat means and what this is. So it just can like simply be like the conversations. Oh, wrapping up now. There was just not much more to be said, you know, because
I think that Kevin's is the best.
To explain, you know,
right.
And like, justify my time, like, you know, because I'm asking you to take my child somewhere, you know, to be accountable for my kid because I'm going on retreat, and that's.
I think it's either Kevin's answer that I'm just going to relax, or Lorna's answer that I don't conform to anything and that's why I'm going there. Another great discussion.
For you, Laura, I have to remember that. Well, that you can see that you can see it coming up and go like, nope.
They don't care anyway.
That's what you're saying. Well, yeah. Beyond that point of trying to engage someone in their own views, people don't care.
But I think, you know, because I sometimes turn against myself, and that's where I'll start explaining, because I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm going on a retreat again. Like, I have to, and somebody's got to take my kids and feed the cats, and like, I have to somehow make it sound, because I'm uncomfortable.
You're not fully convinced yourself yet. So.
Yeah.
You don't have to defend it. You don't have to justify it. But you don't have to talk about it either.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I mean that's the energy sometimes that I'll find myself in. The person doesn't really care, but eye making has arrived.
Their response to you will tell you the level of interest they actually have. And if you shouldn't go any further.
Yeah, oh, exactly.
Yeah.
And sometimes the situation gives you the license. Kevin would know. I teach somewhat differently in Clinton, or outside of Cross River Meditation Center, than I do in it. There's just things that I talk about, and I'm much more direct. Because when someone's coming into that center, I feel that I have a responsibility and a license to say certain things, but when I'm in another facility, a healthcare facility, it's a little different situation. So I don't, when Kevin reminded me, the second talk I did give was on dependent origination, which I thought I never did, but I I just have this thing called conditioned thinking, and I can't help myself. But in general, I do present it in a different way.
People who would arrive at Clinton are just curious, but they're not necessarily seeking.
Yeah.
They don't know about the Dhamma, or they just want to relax.
Yeah.
Too, they just want to figure out how to de-stress.
Oh yeah, I think a lot.
Working too, yep, sometimes, and I notice your approach is different because you have to be accepting of that and gauging, and you have 10 different people who are coming from 10 different directions.
Yeah.
It's different from the Sangha. You know, some of those people might become part of the Sangha, but many, the first night when it was free, there were 2 dozen people there.
Yep.
Before.
Yep.
The room was packed, and then the next week you paid, and there were 6 people.
Yeah. Because they found out what I was teaching.
Yeah,
well, I'm making a joke of it, but they found out what I was teaching. But in a very general way, I explain that I teach meditation with them. You know, not just meditation, as a broader framework. But I certainly I couldn't go on if I didn't at least say that, because I'm not going to teach a class where I say, okay, you know, just sit here for 20 minutes, bye. Because to me, I'm misleading people. I'm hurting people that way. I'm creating an environment where they are putting themselves in a situation where they can only reconfirm and strengthen their conditioned thinking. So I don't do that.
Yeah.
Even though there were people in the past that asked me if I would just do that, and I said I can't. And so, boy, what another great discussion. So. I said we were going to stop a little bit early. It's 4:15, so there's still time to enjoy the grounds. Is there anything else that we'd like to talk about? Okay, so I'll see you at dinner. We'll have and then we'll meet back down here at 7 tonight, I think, is the schedule. Talk about the Four Noble Truths. Thank you all.
Thanks.